Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. We welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. It's my great pleasure to introduce Professor Dr. Keltner from University of California, Berkeley, with his latest great book and set of ideas and research on what drives us to power, what works and what fails us, both the things that work, and if it works initially, it fails in the long run. Just a great, great idea, Professor Dr. Keltner, and the name of the book is The Power Paradox.
Thank you, George, and thank you all for being here. It's always funny. I've stiff competition tonight with the Warriors, so I really appreciate your presence tonight. It was almost like the night I was up in Portland, Oregon, and my competition was Noam Chomsky, who's a big draw up in Portland, Oregon, and so sort of similar thing. When I was about 9 years old, my mom and dad did something really unusual that really spurred the science that I'm going to talk to you about tonight, which is my mom had just gotten her PhD from UCLA, and in 1970, much different era than it is today, we moved up to Northern California. And my parents did a kind of a radical experiment, which is that we moved from a hilly neighborhood called Laurel Canyon in Los Angeles, which is an upper middle class neighborhood where the kids do well and the schools are strong and everybody has nice trajectories. And my parents moved us to the poorest town in one of the poorest, probably the poorest counties in California at the time in 1970. And it was a wonderful time that taught me about the warmth and the kindness of the rural poor in California. But I noticed something really strange that I just couldn't make sense of when I was 9 and 10 years old when we made that move. And what I noticed very gradually was that the people around me, my neighbors, my friends, were sick and they were dying. If you start at the top of our road on KO Drive, the family lived in kind of Appalachian-type conditions. They had no floorboard in their kitchen. The dad clearly was massively depressed with dark circles under his eyes. His son fell off our swing, and it broke his arm really unexpectedly with a small fall. And now we call that child frailty syndrome, which is something about his living conditions was destroying the strength of his bones. If you go across the street, there was a neighbor who I only saw once in my 10 years living there. His shutters were drawn, and I would learn in graduate school what the name of his condition was. It's agoraphobia. It's this paralyzing form of anxiety disorder where you literally can't go outside. You go down a couple of houses on our little windy lane, and there was my best friend's home, Memo Campos, a family from Mexico. Memo's sister had leukemia early in life, and his dad, who was kind of the neighborhood provider of sodas and beers whenever we had picnics and political gatherings, got cancer and blew his brains out in his 60s because he just didn't want to face a life of dying of cancer.
This
is called Penryn, California. Yeah, it's in Placer County. You go down a few houses, and there were three families from Oklahoma, the Skellingers. One of the parents died in her 40s and was massively overweight. And that, what I sort of got a sense of at the time, and I really couldn't put my finger on it, was, you know, this is just the quirky fates of people who live out in the country. And I, as a young kid, you know, it was just part of life and part of the random distribution of ills when you live in places that are off the grid. And what I've learned in the past 30 years in looking at this science, and I'll try to convey to you today, is that what was shortening the lives of my neighbors and my friends was powerlessness, was their place in society. And that would really come to be kind of the central insight that I would kind of move toward in the science that I'm about to describe to you. So what I'd like to do is to talk about this science of power. Frankly, psychological science, and I'm a social psychologist by training, was really blind, like a lot of people in the United States, to the very nature of what power is and how fundamental it is to our relations to one another. And as I started this science of power, I was struck by this quote by Bertrand Russell, the great philosopher, who was writing in 1938 as fascism was on the rise, and he said, you know, just as energy is the fundamental concept in physics that defines
as George was hinting at in his comments, the relations between objects, power is the basic medium in which we relate to other human beings. It's the fundamental sort of stuff of human relations. Social psychology, my discipline, was blind to that possibility. And today, we look at human relations through a much different lens. When I began this science some 20 years ago, really 25 years ago, thinking about my neighbors, thinking about how power relates to things like racism and depression and the functioning of the immune system, we really, as a discipline, encountered a few basic problems that I hope to give you some working solutions to as we move through this science. What is power? How do we get it? Does power change once I have it? Or does a life of privilege change how I behave? Does power corrupt, and does absolute power corrupt absolutely? What makes for strong social systems that constrain what I would sort of posit are near inevitable misuses of power? And I think that's a very timely question when we think about American politics today. In fact, this is a deep sort of issue within social systems that has been evolving since we were hunter-gatherers. And then to return to the conditions of the lives of the people I grew up around, what can we say about what does power do to the human psyche? And as we are advancing in this science, I have come to believe, and this is not new, that most of the problems of today that matter most to us are really problems of power, from depression to anxiety disorders to the functioning of your immune system to why poor kids die 6 to 10 years earlier just by the neighborhood that they're born into, to the lone wolf shooters that are worrying us today when we think about the Orlando shooter. So that's where we're going to go today. So first up, what is power? As a social scientist, there's a lot of work in the sort of conceptualizing what power is in economics and political science and sociology, kind of the great traditions in this inquiry as well as history. And just to simplify, they've tended to conceptualize power. And when I started this science, I would bump into these definitions as economic might or the control over capital, as access to political decision-making processes, or military might in a lot of historical analyses. And I think that this conceptualization of power as asymmetrical force, if you will, runs into a lot of conceptual and empirical problems. The first problem is actually, it's an example that I pose, a question I pose people, but it actually has very serious theoretical underpinnings to this. If you take the average American citizen in the United States, who has a bigger influence on that person's nervous system? Taylor Swift, the pop star, or Joe Biden, our vice president? Who would you say? Right? And you can debate this, but the point being that that cultural figures who don't necessarily have access to military might or political power end up influencing us enormously. If you want to see the deep scholarship around that, you should read Pierre Bourdieu, Michel Foucault, who write about the influence of ideas and cultural trends and art as being as consequential to power as the classic dimensions of power. Another example has to do with this photo right here. The idea that power is just asymmetric force rooted in money and politics and military might does not make sense of the power that voteless, penniless weaklings wield in the world, namely our children. This is a photo taken from a vacation that I was on with those are my two daughters who are now much older. We're on a bike ride through Zion National Park. I, as a psychologist, had said, you know, for every 500 pedals of the bike, you get a handful of M&Ms. Halfway into the ride, their faces are covered in chocolate, their teeth are falling out. And I said, no more M&Ms, right? And they countered with those facial expressions right there. Who do you think won that negotiation? I was like, okay, I was kidding. Here are the keys to the car, right? But the point being, power isn't just money and politics. It's every second of face-to-face life in our families, in our romantic partnerships, in our friendships. There are now theoretical treatments of the relationship between the developing fetus and the mother that really frame it, rightfully so, as a power struggle over resources in the womb, right? And that dictates a variety of different processes. So What I do in the first piece to The Power Paradox is, as a psychologist interested in Bertrand Russell's notion that power is part of every relationship, is I broaden the definition. And what we, and this is really building on a lot of scholarship, wherein I say power is the individual's capacity to alter the states of another individual. You can alter the economic state, the political state, the emotional state, the physical state. This broadens out to help us think about how power really is everywhere. But it does more than that. It starts to help us gain insight into real consequential power that begins in the absence of money in politics and military might. And, you know, I'll just give you a few examples. Power is found in great ideas. That's Thomas Clarkson, a 19-year-old who wrote an essay about the horrors of the slave ships. And that essay, for a Latin contest, written by a 19-year-old student adrift, literally historically changed the abolitionist movement and really was led to, in many historical analyses, the ending of slavery and the foundation of world economy at the time. Power is in information. Power is in basic social ties. That's Ella Baker, who worked tirelessly in the NAACP, building the civil rights movement in the 1950s down in the South. And it is not a stretch of the imagination to say Ella Baker's work, going around to neighborhoods, linking people, led to the civil rights movement, led to the free speech movement at UC Berkeley, who was inspired by the civil rights movement, which led to the anti-war movements. Ella Baker has a profound influence on our sense of political participation today through building social ties. There is no more dramatic shift in the relations between men and women and the lives of women than Margaret Sanger and Jeffrey Pincus's development of the birth control pill. That simple, weird, technological, scientific innovation changed how many babies women had. It dramatically cut them. It lengthened their lives. It changed sexual relationships. That simple development had a massive influence on societal organization. It didn't begin with money or military might or politics, but it had as profound a change as any you could come up with as Margaret Sanger and culture. Power is your capacity to alter the states of others. Question two, how do we get power? If I want my child to go off into the world and make a difference in the world and alter the states of others for the good, what should they do, right? If you get a job and you're now working in a new organization, you want to rise in the ranks and do good things for the world or make money or whatever your interest is, what should you do? I'm going to move through dozens of years of scholarship. There's a really interesting, there are deep contextual issues here, deep historical issues here. And I'm going to simplify a little, but talk about broad trends. You can think about a couple of basic strategies that are rooted in different philosophies of power about how we gain influence in the world. One, the most influential philosophy of power for 500 years was Niccolo Machiavelli's The Prince. A lot of historical scholarship around this, a lot of debate. I'm happy to take it up in the Q&A. Machiavelli wrote, it's important to remember, in Renaissance Italy, he had just been tortured, thrown out of his job, was probably depressed, and seeking to re-enter into the political context of Florentine politics, wrote The Prince during what most people recognize was the most violent time in probably human history, was 15th century Renaissance Italy. When you read the historical accounts of Machiavelli's life, rape was everywhere, violence was everywhere, torture was public. You know, people were killed, drawn, and quartered for public entertainment. This is a very interesting historical moment. And he authored his Force and Fraud philosophy of power. I've given you a sort of a contemporary feel to this. These are some laws of power that come out of this philosophy that really a lot of people believe to be true, right? Conceal your intentions. Court attention at all costs. Always have the people you're leading be thinking about you. And I know you're thinking of managers right now, or that reminds me of somebody in the workplace. Use selective honesty and generosity to disarm your victims. Heck, let's just cut straight to the chase. Crush everybody totally as the Machiavellian philosophy of power. What I can tell you, and you know, I was talking to George earlier about, you know, this is where science is useful. We can test these ideas. Does that philosophy work? Well, what we know is it's preferred by the disenfranchised. It tends to work in the short term in really violent adversarial contexts, right? But it fails in a lot of contexts where it really matters. So, for example, this is so telling today. There are historians now who are looking at what determines the success of protest movements, right? And they compare a violent, ruthless Machiavellian approach with a collaborative approach. These are 323 protest movements from around the world fighting military dictatorships, East Timor, South America, and the like. And it turns out that Machiavellian violent strategies fail. They only succeed about 25% of the times. The more collaborative consensus-building strategies tend to prevail over 50% of the time. So it fails there. It doesn't work at work, this Machiavellian strategy. We recently published a paper, very timely today, of U.S. senators and whether they got support for the bills they were championing. We coded the nonverbal behavior of their speeches for Machiavellian sociopathic tendencies. And this will perhaps remind you of somebody today. The Machiavellian sociopathic tendencies were identified in nonverbal behaviors. Did they laugh at the suffering of other people? And did they show these sort of self-love display behaviors like puckering the lips and smiling in a sense of smug self-satisfaction? Does that remind you of anybody today? They got nothing done in the U.S. Senate. And in fact, our senators who, and this is from the 1990s, who had sort of expressed humanity and courage, got a lot of support for their bills. So the Machiavellian strategy, force, ruthlessness, deception, works somewhere, but not too many places. And by contrast, what I write about, these are old principles, is, and this is counterintuitive, but I will bore you with the data that support this, that in general, groups give power to individuals who do a good job of advancing what utilitarian philosophers call the greater good, we give power to people who lift up the interests of the most people, right? And what this translates to is you get more power if you share resources. This is found in hunter-gatherer societies and new economic data, where if I'm sharing within a social collective, people give me a lot of respect and opportunities for influence. You get a lot of power through empathy and listening carefully to other people's interests. There are now studies in schools, organizational units, finance firms, military units, showing if I am a good student of human nature and know what people think, I rise in power. You get power through storytelling and gratitude and expressions of appreciation. One of the greatest examples of this, and I'll give you a scientific example, is Abraham Lincoln, rated by historians as our greatest president. Abe Lincoln was poor. He was awkward looking. He wore funny clothes by all accounts. He was 6'4", had funny posture. He was not predicted by anybody to rise to win the Republican nomination. He navigated through very violent politics, as you all know, and held the nation together. This is Thurlow Weed, a journalist at the time who really studied Lincoln carefully, who really sums up this idea of it's really people who sort of advance the interests of the many who gain power. His mind is at once philosophical and practical. He sees all who go there, hears all they have to say, talks freely with everybody, and reads whatever is written to him. He dignified everybody and really honored the interests and ideas of the citizens. It's interesting, in doing the science, a historian told me about FDR, also rated as one of our great presidents. His aides hated this, but they designed a special car that FDR could drive around so that he could drive to small towns without his entourage and just hang out with the citizens, right, and hear what they had to say. Great leadership, because it really is found in a focus on other people. Let me work through how I write about this in more specific terms. And this is coming out of kind of studies of what do pro-social behaviors do within social networks, like a workplace, a neighborhood that you live in, as studied by Nicholas Christakis and James Fowler, or a school that your child may belong to, or a military unit, any kind of social network that you're part of. These are kind of the mechanisms by which sharing and empathy and acts of kindness actually counterintuitively get you power, even though you're sacrificing from one perspective. So take the case of sharing a resource or expressing gratitude. If somebody like Maria shares with Samir, we now know neuroscientifically that act of generosity activates reward circuits in the brain, so the perpetrator of the good act feels good about it. That act then stimulates whomever you are sharing with to then be more pro-social and cooperative in other contexts. James Fowler has elegant work. For every act of generosity that I direct to George, George is now 19% more cooperative in his next interaction. I'm not even there. The people he's interacted with are now 7% more collaborative and cooperative in their next interaction. George is not there. Those are twice, three times removed from my act of generosity, building up collaborative networks. We now know from studies of reputation in social networks, if I act in a generous way, people are spreading information that I'm actually a decent leader, right? And they will be more open to my influence. They will direct esteem to me, right? The original perpetrator of the act of generosity. And that sense of social esteem, neuroscientific study shows, activates reward circuits of the brain that are activated by eating chocolate. Doing good things co-opts the systems that are activated by eating chocolate and getting a massage. They reward these pro-social tendencies and build out collaborative networks. I've explored this in really counterintuitive ways, for example, with touch, and this is very timely tonight where this work is going, which is we know simple acts of touch reward others. They stimulate cooperation in people I'm working with. They encourage really positive actions in other people. When teachers who are trying to influence those unruly kids in their class pat kids on the back, those kids are 3 to 5 times more likely to go up to a blackboard and solve a hard problem, right? That act of kindness is saying, you belong here, feel free, and it calms them down. I am going to show you timely for tonight. We actually were interested in whether nice acts of encouraging touch make for stronger, more powerful teams. So my collaborators and I coded one game of every team in the National Basketball Association at the start of the 2008 season. And we coded 2 minutes of touch in each game. Here's what you see: high fives, fist bumps, arm embraces, bear hugs, head wraps. Men like to hit each other in the head to say good job. Arm embraces, chest bumps, flying hip bumps, and flying chest bumps if everything's going exceptionally well, as it hopefully is tonight with the Warriors. And the teams who touched each other more won more games. I can debate the statistics with you later. And the players who touched each other in these encouraging ways, our statistical analysis showed, made their teammates play a lot better over the course of the season. Subtle acts of generosity increase power and influence. Okay, this is an old principle, set of principles in the literature. This is a summary of what makes for a great leader in hunter-gatherer societies. We have to remember hunter-gatherer societies really living for 200,000 years in the conditions of Homo sapien evolution. What did it take to really get things done in those societies that defined our context of evolution? Kindness, bravery, being open, reliable, tactful, and humble and strong. You needed this mixture of pro-social tendencies that lift up other people's welfare. So that's all fine and dandy. You know, the good stuff kind of gets you power in most contexts. We can debate when Machiavellianism prevails. But regrettably, here comes the source of the title of my book, The Power Paradox, which is, you know, wow, all this pro-social stuff, people respect me. I get opportunities for influence. I get work done in organizations. But regrettably, the feeling of powerful, being powerful, the sense that you're on top, coming from a life of privilege and the sense of superiority, activates a lot of processes in the brain, like a sense of self-focus, a little bit of narcissism, a little bit of grandiosity, and a little bit of euphoria, where you become blind to the risks that accompany your actions. And that cocktail of sense feelings, when I feel powerful, unleashes a lot of problematic, abusive behavior. That's the paradox. We get power by being empathetic and kind, and then having power short circuits those tendencies. Let me show you some data. We know with studies, when I have power, I gamble more, I take more risks. In workplaces, 3 out of 4 rude, uncivil behaviors in an organization come from the people at the top of the organizational ladder. Who's more likely to shoplift, the wealthy or the poor? That doesn't make any economic sense, but they are much more likely to shoplift than the poor. There's sexual impropriety that comes with power. We wanted to demonstrate this power corrupts with a very basic behavior, which is eating. There may be no more basic behavior other than sex than eating food. We brought people to the lab. We appointed one person, the powerful person. We pointed to them randomly and said, "You're in charge." They then did this really boring task for an hour. Half an hour into the study, we bring a plate of 5 delicious chocolate chip cookies. Everybody eats one cookie. All groups leave one cookie on the plate. Our key question was, who eats that 4th cookie? Indeed, it's the high power person right there. Reaches out and says, "That's mine." We coded laboriously how they eat their cookies. High power people are more likely to eat their cookies with their mouths open, lips smacking, and crumbs falling all over their sweaters, right? So, and I could go on. We did another study that really looked at privilege. You may have heard about this study, and I know I'll get all kinds of attack or sort of counterexamples. We were interested in a really simple question. There are health consequences to this. There are pedestrian zones on California roads that are designated with white stripes. And if you're driving a car, you're supposed to let pedestrians cross and stop, right? But we know that doesn't happen all the time. And our question was, who's more likely to blaze through a pedestrian zone with someone waiting there, a driver of a wealthy car or drivers of poor cars, okay? So we created this score for cars on California highways. On the left is like a little AMC Pacer or something. That's gets a low score on our class scale of cars. And over here's a fancy Mercedes. I think it costs $120,000 or whatever. So we scale our cars accordingly. And we positioned a Berkeley undergraduate at a pedestrian zone. They looked at one car coming down the way and acted like they wanted to go across the street, right? And we simply tallied up who ignores the pedestrian, drives through the pedestrian zone, and here's what we find. If you're driving a poor car, they always stop and follow the law. By contrast, if you're driving a fancy Range Rover or a Mercedes, 46% of the time they blaze through the zone, the pedestrian zone, ignoring the pedestrian. And I know you're asking questions like, what about a Prius? We got a lot of those questions. We analyzed the data. Prius drivers were the worst because they're like, I can cut through this zone because I'm not using as much, you know, fuel or whatever it is. So, and that led Conan O'Brien to make a joke. Here, Prius drivers are the worst drivers because they drive around patting themselves on the back. Anyway, lots of worry about that. There are a lot of studies. I want to move to the final piece of data for you. We also find a lot of empathy deficits that come with power. just have feeling powerful, you stop listening to people as carefully. You are more likely to stereotype other people by gender or race. You are less likely to take their perspective. It really diminishes our capacity to take the other perspective. Okay. So this will probably come up in discussion. It's actually very deeply relevant to thinking about what makes for strong social systems. But I want to get to the empirical answer and have time for 15 minutes of Q&A to the question we began with, which is how do I think about what was hurting my neighbors' lives? Our studies show, and there are hundreds like it, that you know if you just randomly give somebody power, random assignment, that feeling of being above people unleashes these impulsive tendencies. And one of the questions that that raises, which I think is fundamental, and really it's almost the domain of political science, and thinking brought more or sociology, is how do we think about social systems that keep the abuses of power in check? And we're getting preliminary answers from social psychology that, you know, if you make people accountable, they will not abuse their power. And you think about the 2008 economic collapse, well, there wasn't accountability. They made decisions and no one got to see. It took someone like Michael Lewis and years of reporting to figure out what in the world led to those collateralized debt swaps that were the beginning of our economic problems. Capacity to form strong ties is fundamental to constraining the abuses of power. It's so interesting how Stalin and Hitler, you know, when you read their histories, the first thing they do is sever the ties between people in communities through suspicion and distrust and whispering and so forth. The ability to scrutinize leaders through things like journalism and even satire and gossip are fundamental to keeping the abuses of power in check. Again, it's so fascinating. Hitler and Stalin were obsessed with just undermining the forms of scrutiny, be it in journalism or the intelligentsia or in art. Hitler was obsessed with controlling art in his Germany because art's often a form of social criticism. These are the properties of healthy social systems and lead to the abuses of power. So let me end with a little bit of new data that inspired me to do this science. You know, we have lost the war on poverty, regrettably, some 50 years ago. You know, today we have as many people in poverty as back then, as Paul Pearson at UC Berkeley has shown. There are historic levels of inequality today. You know, these are just some of the data of what a four-person household, what percentage is at U.S. poverty levels. You know, about a fifth of children in the United States, one out of seven children in the United States have hunger problems. This is true even in the University of California, where kids are hungry, and it's distracting them from school. And that was the state of the kids that I grew up around, is they were not going to go to college. A lot of them would flame out before graduating from high school. They ended up in prison. Some of them did. They died very unusual deaths early. And they really struggled in school. And when I thought about all the kinds of critiques of those who are in poverty that I would hear after growing up in that kind of condition, it just didn't make sense, right? That they were lazy. People were working hard. You know, the families I grew up around, they were working in mills that broke bodies, right? The kids worked jobs in high school. They didn't care about school. My neighbors wanted to do well in school. They just had trouble, right? And now we know there are neuroscience studies showing that if you grow up in poverty, your frontal lobes lose about 10% of growth by the time you're 11 or 12 years old through just the direct effects of poverty on your brain. So that just didn't make sense. And what we've now learned is what really I feel is one of the most important lessons from this new science of power that I review in the last chapter of the power paradox, which is this is your stress system. It's an ancient part of the mammalian nervous system, the HPA axis, the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. When you see a threat in your environment, we used to think the bear, right, or a predator, That system kicks into gear, sends signals to your adrenal glands pump cortisol into your blood, and your body is ready to defend itself. Your heart is racing, your muscles are contracting, your digestion shuts down, your sexual response shuts down. You're ready to do combat, right? And that's great in the short term. It is terrible news in the long term, right? And we were learning 20, 30 years ago, and I'll show you some findings, wow, if I am chronically stressed out and this system kicks into gear, it hurts my digestive tract, it hurts my cells, the telomeres at the end of your DNA start shortening, it hurts brain cells. It's bad to be stressed. And then a review of a couple of hundred studies discovered what the basic source of stress is for the human being. And it's not the saber-toothed tiger, and it is not the big bear. It is being disempowered, right? It is being socially rejected and disempowered. So what we're learning is this old mammalian system is actually a system that is most hyperactivated when you as a part of a community feel disrespected or disempowered. So studies show if I'm the target of a racist belief, this system becomes hyperactive. If I'm a woman and I hear about data showing and made up data that women will never have power, this system becomes hyperactivated. If I feel stigmatized, Rudy Mendoza Denton at Berkeley has shown, for my class identity, if I go to a wealthy school and I'm lower class and I feel like there are biases against me, this system becomes hyperactivated. If I have lack of voice, attacks on sexual identity, even just being disrespected activates that. And then what we know, this also activates, this picture is of the cytokine response and inflammation response in your body. This is one of the hottest areas of health science right now. When your body has a pathogen in it or you have a flu, your body inflames and your tissues swell up, you get mucus, you get sluggish, you don't want to eat, you sleep all the time. That's your inflammation response, trying to get rid of toxins. Well, when we feel disempowered or when we come from poor backgrounds, the inflammation response, and these are the little cytokine proteins going from one cell to another, are hyperactivated, and it literally is hard to concentrate in school and hard to be physically healthy because of this powerlessness. So what this led to are just a couple of findings that everybody should be aware of. Nancy Adler, groundbreaking discovery. For every rung I drop down the ladder, wealth-wise, I live a shorter life. If my neighbor is an 8 and I'm a 7, and we go to the same doctor and eat the same food, and our kids go to the same school, that person's an 8 and I'm a 7, I live a shorter life just by the sense of being below. Poverty, Greg Miller, Edith Chen. If I am raised in poverty through threats and structural factors, I feel constantly disempowered and under attack, and my cytokine response is hyperactive. They can bring in kids who are 5 years old, and their bodies are inflamed as if poisoned, and they're losing 6 to 10 years of life expectancy by the time they're 10 or 11 years old, just by the body's response to disempowerment. To me, what this tells us is, you know, when we think about why are kids stressed out? Why is there so much depression? Why Americans use so many pharmaceuticals? We got to be thinking about the powerlessness that's produced by things like inequality. And I'm happy to talk to you at greater length about all of the new data showing that when we disempower members of our society, a lot of social, emotional ills ensue, and we have the most unequal society in the industrialized world. Hence, Bernie Sanders' draw as a politician. This also tells us there are great ways to intervene, right? That if we teach teachers empathy, they no longer suspend African-American kids at disproportionate rates, which is a really serious risk factor for kids starting in kindergarten. Just teach teachers a little empathy, 50% drop in suspension rates school-wide. My lab is looking at nature as a counterpoint to poverty, because we know nature strengthens your nervous system. So we're taking kids, those are our data right there, kids from Oakland and Richmond, getting them out with the Sierra Club onto the white waters of different rivers in California, and they come back physically stronger because of these benefits of nature as forms of empowerment. So we live in an incredibly interesting time in terms of power. These are just some of the radical changes that are happening. Women are now rising in power, new countries, new forms of influence. You probably have questions about new rights movements and the like. So it is a time, as you all know, where daily we are questioning what power and influence are, right? Will we return to kind of older models, more coercive models, or are we moving broadly towards this more collaborative model, which some of the data suggests we are? And that's why it's great to be part of this conversation. And I wanted to thank you for all of your attention and look forward to what you have to say about the power paradox. The Warriors are ahead. The Warriors are up by three. Now you can concentrate.
So I'd like to remind our radio and online audiences that they're listening to Professor Dr. Keltner speaking about his book, The Power Paradox, at the Commonwealth Club. It's time for questions. I'll start with one. There's two problems that compete with each other. You said the importance of touch.
Yeah.
And there's the sexual harassment thing. And especially with children and teachers, I was wondering if you wanted to say anything about that. Because if we become a society that no one can touch each other, we have another issue.
We do. Yeah. You know, and this is one of these places where cost-benefit analyses are really helpful. You know, George raises this question. I go around and I teach schools and I teach school administrators and also hospital settings and workplaces where they're like, you can't touch anybody. And yet we know from a deep science that touch is our basic form of connecting and very rich language of communication that builds up trust and cooperation. And I think what I see happening in this tension of watching out for sexual harassment versus thinking about the benefits of touch is that the really innovative teachers in schools and workplace colleagues do it in a really friendly, imaginative, standardized way. So my favorite example was a school teacher who said, you know, my principal told me I can't touch kids, and yet, man, you have a little first grade boy who's really having trouble sitting still, which I had trouble doing, and my hand on his back really helps. And so what she did is she standardized touch such that she, as the kids were leaving at the end of the day, she stood outside. Each kid in front of the parents came by and gave a hug to the teacher, and it was the best part of their day, right? They left in this wonderful state, and no principal is going to say, you can't do that, you know? So so I think it takes a little bit of wisdom and contextual sensitivity to reintroduce touch in the right ways, because we would lose a lot, as you're saying, George, if we lost touch, a lot.
Hi.
Hey.
My question is about unstructured situations and power in families. And a lot of your research, it sounds like, is, you know, more political and health systems and that sort of thing. What about, you know, situations where you have power in families, and how do you handle those situations?
Well, you know, this is the reason. Thank you for asking that. This is the
bad
reason.
Power, I should say.
Yeah, this is the reason I wrote the book, right? Which is that a lot of the traditional analysis of power, although early feminist scholarship challenged it, but the traditional analysis is power is on the battlefield, it's in the U.S. Senate, and it's in the boardroom, right? And when you come home, you live in a power-free zone. And when I would come home from being a professor, I was negotiating with two-year-olds, I was negotiating with my wife, there are power dynamics everywhere, and Bertrand Russell got it right, which, as he said, power is the basic medium of every relationship. And I encountered this finding in developmental science that changed how I think about power dynamics in every intimate relationship. And it was that if a parent wants to raise, in today's society, a child who's going to be a cooperative member of society and do pretty well, one strategy is you kind of do a laissez-faire approach to parenting, anarchy, doesn't work. The other strategy is the authoritarian strategy. I'm dad, I'm older, I tell you what's right and wrong. That doesn't work either. What works is this mutual empowerment approach that developmental scientists call inductive reasoning, where you get kids to reason about stuff, you engage them, you give them voice, and they do really well developmentally. And that finding, mutual empowerment in intimate life, works for parent-child dynamics, it works for sibling dynamics, and it even works in the intimate realm, where studies find when romantic partners both feel empowered, they're happier, their sex lives are better, they feel more committed. So I trace that back to, you know, our earlier social origins, where egalitarianism tended to prevail and was kind of the default model, if you will, of how we relate to each other and healthier.
This is very thought-provoking. My friend Michael Freeman and I are taking a course at San Francisco State Adult Education on terrorism.
Yeah.
And the question came up about the leaders of these terrorist organizations.
Yeah.
And that brought up, and I'm a biological determinist, and I have a science background, of psychopathic behavior.
Yeah.
You know, the people, as you know, are 4-5% males and less than 1% females.
Yeah.
They're pathological liars. They have charisma. They're unsquelchable. They have charm. They're narcissistic, et cetera. And as you well know, there are certain areas of the brain that don't light up on functional MRI, you know, the frontal parietal, the cingulate gyrus, and the people with the lack of conscience, the guy with the from the Vermont quarry in 1840s who had a bolt through his prefrontal. So is that where the power structure is? And these psychopaths, they'll always be with me, and how do you deal with that?
Yeah, that is the question of the day, isn't it? And, you know, I really... you know, I think that the kind of you would always have to think about multiple determinants, right? So people have written about how structural inequality becomes this sort of, especially when you have a bunch of young men who are out of work, that's a recipe for violent extremism. And that's been documented historically. So I put that into the mix. And then given that social context, I think you're right that, although I don't know of any data that speak to this, but in the context of lack of opportunity, a lot of young men who are not engaged in a society through work or the like, and an ethos of violence, you have this opportunity for psychopathic Machiavellian leadership styles emerging. And I think that you could test that in different ways, and I think it's a fair portrayal of the tenor of extremist ideology right now. So.
Well, you know that Harvard Business School study that said that, 65 of 70% of the CEOs are psychopathic.
Yeah, and then you always wonder about causality. And I would say that's not how they got there. That's what being a CEO did to them. Yeah, and so, yeah. But it's a timely question and well put. Natalie.
I was wondering about if there's much empirical data on this idea that, as you suggest or argue around sort of powerlessness at the bottom of the social strata, if you've seen much data around sort of powerlessness at the top of the social strata, and if the kind of optimal is the middle. Just I was thinking about your story and I moved to a low-income area when I was in high school, and it wasn't as poor as the one you moved into, but it was low-income, and there was a lot of contentment compared to the rich area I had moved out of. So I'm just wondering if you have any data on that.
Yeah. There is a little bit of data by my colleague Jen Lerner, who teaches at Harvard, that you know even successful managers, when they don't feel powerful, show this really problematic profile. They have stress and cortisol and the like. And then the second observation you offer, and I think it's really important for us to think about, is, you know, societally, where's the sweet spot of well-being and innovation and goodwill? And it is probably in the middle, because my research shows the very upper realms of the strata, they don't connect to others as well, they don't empathize as well, they don't share. Right. And so Robert Reich has made a similar argument about, boy, a strong middle class has economic benefits, and these data suggest it's also going to have social benefits. It's backed up by other kinds of data out there. So it's a good question. Yes.
Anytime you have two people come together, you have a society, and every society has a leader and a follower, and the rest are followers. And in my life, I've had the opportunity to be a general manager of several men and women. And your talk is kind of is simplistic, because my experience is, if you want to lead the crew, you have to get to know each individual and what their trigger is.
Right.
And then you have to mollify your presentation to them.
Yes.
So that you, like you just said, you go through the middle.
Right.
Am I right on what I'm talking to you about?
You're totally right.
Okay.
Hence my quote from Abraham Lincoln, right? Greatest U.S. president, but as rated by historians from both U.K. and U.S., and he saw and heard everybody. So that is a...
If you get to know them, then they will listen to you when you lead them.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Doris Kearns wrote a book on his cabinet, that he picked, that Lincoln picked a cabinet of the most, even people who didn't like each other, but that he was willing to lead it. And I think that people can see that in a leader. The leaders who are afraid to have good people around them,
yeah,
are just showing off the weakness of their leadership.
Yeah, yeah. Well put.
This slide, I think it was the one before this one that talked about inequality, the one before this one. They talked about climate change. Inequality was like the greatest stressor. I forget exactly what the wording was.
Yeah.
That. Can you talk a little bit more about what you mean by that?
Sure. Sure. So, you know, thank you for asking that question. So when you're somebody like me and you travel around and talk to parent groups and groups like this and group organizations, we are in a period in our culture. We're worked up. And there's a lot of anxiety right now that's been well documented. And we're wondering, like, what's going on with our culture? And for some people, it's bullying in schools. And for some people, it is the lone shooter, right, that we just had in Orlando. And for other people, it's why are certain populations underperforming in terms of their physical health? Our culture underperforms in terms of how long we live. For other people, it's the criminal justice system, which is, why do African Americans get a different sentence for a drug compared to a European American and the new Jim Crow, as Michelle Alexander wrote. And we come up with these stories, but what we're learning is that systemic inequality, if I live in a neighborhood where there's inequality, if I live in a state like California where there's a lot of inequality, triggers all of these problematic processes, right? If I'm at a school where there's inequality, bullying's more likely to happen. Kids are more likely to fight. My gums are more likely to suffer gum disease. We have data showing if I'm in a state where there's inequality, my marriage feels less loving because I would argue, I hate to use this language, our natural state is more egalitarian, and deviations from that state produce a lot of problematic emotions and ideologies. So that if we solve that one, inequality, a lot of these problems will drop pretty precipitously.
I guess my question is, so I work on climate change issues.
Right.
And so, of course, that's the biggest issue to me.
I agree.
But climate change doesn't rank when people are polled about, like, what their biggest concerns are.
Yeah.
More like jobs.
Yeah.
You know, economy.
Yep.
So I guess I don't understand how you're putting those two things together.
Well, I'm saying, as a scientist who steps back and says, how will my daughters be living in a good world 20 years from now? You know, climate change is number one.
Okay.
But inequality, a ton of data suggests if we work collectively on that one, then my daughter will be less likely to become depressed or anxious. And she's probably going to live a longer life. And her marriage is going to be happier, right? And the innovation in her workplace will be stronger. Those are all based on empirical findings about the consequences of inequality.
First, I want to say I really appreciate the work that you're doing and the research. It means a ton, inequality in these children growing up. And anyway, I won't be able to
Thank
go
you.
Into it, but I really appreciate it. You were talking about the long-term effects that these children in these poverty situations and the things that you're doing to mitigate that, like getting them to nature. But are there other more like probably simpler ways that we can help them, like just so that they can get through it, get out of it, and then go on to successful lives, like vitamins, meditation, that sort of stuff?
Yeah, you know, well, so I am part of the Greater Good Science Center, which provides a clearinghouse of those things. So we know, like, a little bit of breathing and mindfulness for kids helps calm down their nervous systems and is beneficial for poor kids. I think that the nutrition argument that you allude to will be fundamental. You know, there are really neat studies by Francis Kuo showing this is relevant to climate change, that if you beautify urban blighted areas, those kids concentrate better and do better in school just by adding trees and green lawns. There are studies of music and after school programs that show academic benefits. What I gravitate to is a thinking of, you know, the nervous system gets all stressed out and causes a lot of troubles. And what are the cheap, non-ideological ways? No one would argue against getting kids out camping. Whoever argues against that's got problems, right? And has these enormous benefits. And so I think we need to, you know, and there are a lot of psychologists working on these sort of things that don't face the kind of resistance that you would face by raising taxes to build up this school program that, which I would also endorse, that are ways we can take on these fundamental issues of poverty. And I hope I think they will amount to a next generation of interventions that will win.
Well, you got a question?
Just a comment about the connection, just human connection. I think trumps
all of it.
Everything that you were saying and with kids.
With a careful use of the word Trump in there. But yeah, thank God we haven't talked about that Machiavellian, you know. Connection.
I want to ask if you've looked at the difference between male and female, because you talked about people being conferred power if they work for the greater good. And I would argue that women are expected to be self-sacrificing and are exploited and not respected more if they work hard for others often.
Yeah. Well, it's so fascinating. And I hint at a couple of findings in the power paradox about gender. We know women are on balance a little bit more collaborative in their approach to power and men a little bit more coercive and Machiavellian, especially when they interact with women, which is funny. And we know a few studies have shown, Credit Suisse has a review of that I cite in the power paradox, that when women manage, the teams tend to do a little bit better. And there are laboratory studies that fit that. But we are very early in the gender power experiment, as my daughter reminded me. Women are rising in power in terms of governorships, middle-level management, 40 to 50%, perhaps the next U.S. president. Still glass ceilings for CEOs, but that will change in this next generation. And then we'll have enough data on hand to say, A, do they still manage in collaborative ways, and are there benefits to female leadership? And I think that will prove to be the case. Preliminary data suggests yes.
Great. There's time for one more question.
A few moments ago, one in our audience used the verb trumps, and almost in the Dickensian way, the character of the hour is named Trump.
Yeah.
You know, like they're doing Dickensian. And then you said, thank God we haven't talked about that.
Let's talk about it.
Which to me triggers two things. God, which is a big thing that's missing.
Yeah.
Spiritual things. Why people, half the people in the world, don't give a damn about living in this world. They want to go to the next as soon as possible.
Yeah.
And they're willing to make all kinds of what we would call crazy sacrifices to do that.
I agree.
You know, how does that fit in? And we haven't talked about it, but everything you said to me.
Yeah.
The Rorschach was, this is about the current menace.
Yeah.
Before I left, I looked online before I left to come here, and there's a news story. Donald Trump, his campaign has decided to withdraw the credentials of the Washington Post. They can no longer report.
That sounds scary, doesn't it?
It is. Yeah. It's not scary.
And that's why, Trump is Machiavelli. In ratings of U.S. historians, the lowest rated historians are the most Machiavellian, right? The greatest Machiavellian in U.S. presidency was Nixon. Yeah, Nixon was straight up Machiavelli. The political leaders who were inspired by Machiavelli include Mussolini, Stalin, and Hitler. And he is like textbook Machiavelli. And that's why I put up the strong social systems. If you have scrutiny, critique, journalism, and the like, he will be his undoing. And there are a lot of data that speak to that.
But you said, you know, the people who are motivated vote for Bernie Sanders, but the people are motivated and they're going for Donald Trump. They're driven
I agree. Yeah, absolutely. But I don't think that those will be enough to win the body politic. But it's an interesting question about our society, a disturbing one. Yeah. And then God, from Trump to God, but, you know, I will leave you with this fascinating archaeological set of discoveries that relates to thinking about power. And it's a good way to sum up the end of our conversation, which is for 200,000 years, we lived in these small groups that tended to negotiate power face to face. And it was more egalitarian and more pro-social, not as many gender divisions. When we settled into larger settlements of interlocking tribes, over 1,000 people, agricultural, stable agriculture, a really interesting set of things happened to human power. It became more hierarchical. Slavery emerged 10 to 12,000 years ago. Religion emerged 10 to 12,000 years ago. And polygamy emerged 10 to 12,000 years ago. That is not a coincidence. It's a model of power that I think we're slowly, with a lot of struggle, moving out of, right? Towards a more collaborative model. So God is implicated in that as well. So
he had a bad plan. One of the things you said about women, I think is very interesting, the study between the two ways of doing it. I think when you talk about powerlessness, a lot of the characteristic traits that are said, this is feminine or this is female versus this is male, it has to do with powerlessness, like deviousness.
Yeah.
When you're powerless, in order to get anything you want, you have to be more devious.
Right.
And plenty of men without power are very devious.
Yeah.
And et cetera. So I think that over time, the characteristic traits that are assigned to one or the other of the sexes will disintegrate.
Yeah, I agree.
Because it really has to do with powerlessness and not to sex.
Well put.
I figured that you would.
Yeah, I totally agree, and that's a very radical thesis. So. Yeah.
Okay. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And the Power Paradox is available for sale
thank
right
you.
Outside.
Thank you.
And so ends another event in the 114th year of the Commonwealth Club of California. Thank you very much.
Another great program.